sponsored by the National Capital Mikvah, organized by the National Capital Mikvah. And I not only want to thank you, but I also want to tell you that we really appreciate all your donations to whoever has contributed to this event. Also, a big shkoyach to the sponsors of the event and for the bagels and the food and etc. You know, the events of the past few weeks have really found us our little organization in need of funds. So everything is welcome, and if you can spread the word about our need, it'll be really really appreciated. 12 years ago, it was a couple of months after my conversion to Judaism. I was very fortunate to learn Ed Nishmat. And the time that I spent there greatly shaped my outlook on Yiddishkeit, Torah study, and my role as a Jewish woman. I feel confident saying that without my experience at Nishmat, I would not have become one of the leaders of the National Capital Mikvah. Therefore, I feel very honored to present to you Rabbanit Henkin, who, by the way, just got off a red-eye flight from Israel. and she's absolutely incredible. And she is the, as you know, founder and the dean of Nishmat, a breakthrough institution in Jewish women's learning, and an institution that certainly changes the Jewish women's role in Jewish religious life. So please join me in welcoming the Rabbanit. And
thank you, Adela. Thank you, Rebecca. I'm delighted to be here. Delighted to be here together with you. This is intended to be a shared session, a participatory session. We are a small enough group of people, so interrupt me at any point that you're either not following or that you have some comment to make. Let me introduce by saying that there's a halachic obligation to save another person from any type of injury. It comes from a pasuk in Vayikra, Lo ta'amod al dam re'echa, you shall not stand idly by while blood is shed. But Chazal interpret that as a much broader prohibition, not just the obligation to save a person. For instance, if you see someone drowning, and Rambam says if you're able to swim, then you're obligated to jump in and to save the person who's drowning. But Halakha interprets this, Chazal interprets this as a much broader injunction against witnessing any type of injury and not standing by silently while injury is going on. And I think this community has distinguished itself in a dignified and really exemplary fashion at, by intervening and preventing further injury. And I just wish to give an enormous yishar koach to people who put themselves out on the line in a very, very uncomfortable way in order to fulfill this mitzvah. It's not muvan meilav, it's not understood that people will necessarily do what they should do, and you have done what you should do, and you are to be congratulated both for what you have done and also for the fashion in which you have done. And you've really become a model for others. On Shabbat, I was reading the Pitchei Tshuva and Orach Chaim. This isn't the regular Pitchei Tshuva that you see on Yom Hadayah, but there's a reasonably contemporary, in other words, sometime within the last 150 years, there was written a Pitrei Tshuva on Orachaim, and he speaks eloquently by saying all of the rabbis cry out against Lashon Hara, but I want to cry out against something which is much worse and much more common, which is that people hold their tongues when they should be speaking out in order to, when they should be intervening or speaking out in order to save someone. And they do so out of a fear for Lashon Hara, and therefore I'm going to be speaking out against this. So, again, I say you are to be congratulated as a community for doing the right thing, and in a very dignified way, and you have become a model. But that's not what I want to speak about. What I would like to speak to you about is what excites me very much. I think you may or may not realize it, but you are bringing about a sea change in Jewish life. And I'd like to give you the background. This may have been inadvertent, but I think as a result of what has occurred here, a sea change is in process or is about to be set in motion. I'd like to, as background, describe a little bit of how halakha works. Halakha comes to us in two formats. It comes to us in the format of codes, and it comes to us in the format of an interfacing with the reality of life. By codes, what I mean is the Mishnah all the way to the Mishnah Berurah, that Baalei Halakha, that codifiers of Jewish law have set down Jewish law, what might be called pure law, in the form of code. On the other hand, there is a vast literature of Shelot u'Tshuvot, responsa literature. At least for the last 1,000 years, responsa literature has defined the parameters of Jewish law and Jewish life. And this has to do with the interfacing of Jewish law with the facts of our daily life, the questions that arise out of our life that elicit a response from Jewish law. So that is what's going on here. And I'd like to survey together with you the issue of public roles for women or authority roles for women in Jewish life, and then bring it to the issue which I think would have happened sooner or later, but what happened in your community is precipitating, in my opinion, or will precipitate a change. So follow along with me. There are, you have this in Hebrew and you have this in the English. If there's a second set of sources, I would be happy to receive it so I could look at the two at the same time. Thank you. Okay. There are two issues in halakha. That's fine. Thank you. Okay. There are two issues in halakha which seem to be in conflict with a biblical precedent, and how this is resolved sets the parameters for our contemporary discussions. Those two issues are Melech v'lo Malka, the prohibition of a woman serving as a queen, a regent, and the second is the disqualification of women for judging. The two of those would seem to be in conflict with the same biblical precedent, and that is Dvorah the prophetess. And so I want to walk you through the Rishonim. And I'd like to first make a comment before we walk together through the Rishonim. The Rishonim of the medieval halachic authorities. The comment is there's a machloket in the Gemara in Sukkah about whether you can use the side of an elephant as the side of a sukkah. Assume you're traveling somewhere in the world and you happen to have an elephant, but you do not have that canvas or those boards for the side of a sukkah, and you'd like to use an elephant as the side of the sukkah. Can you use that elephant? The answer for your information is yes, you can, provided the elephant is tied down, because the halachic reasoning is that even if that elephant should die, he will still be the requisite 10 tefachim. So you can use him. He will still be the 10 hands breadths high, so you can use him as the side of the sukkah. The reason I'm beginning with this is because halacha is not imagining, the rabbis, chazal, are not imagining that we will actually use an elephant as a sign of the sukkah. But the point is that the way halacha works to refine the law is to take the most extreme situation imaginable and to ask regarding that situation what would be the law, with the understanding that we're dealing in theoretics and not practical. To be discussing women's leadership up until the 20th century would be to discuss an elephant as the side of the sukkah. In other words, halacha deals with it. It has discussed it. But until we get to the 20th century, you're dealing with something which is totally theoretical. As theoretical as an elephant as the side of a sukkah. Suddenly, in the 20th century, when women's place in society in general began changing, halakha suddenly found itself with practical questions and not just theoretical questions about women's roles. So let's roll back first to the to 1,000 years ago and previously, and see and look at the foundation in the halachic discussion, and then let's move on to contemporary questions that began arising in mid 20th century. The discussion of Melech v'lo Malka, a king and not a queen, begins with a pasuk in Dvarim, which, as you can see, is divided easily into three clauses. Now, whenever there is unnecessary repetition in a pasuk, the assumption being, since the Torah is divine, if there is an awkward formulation, an unnecessary repetition, that comes in order to teach us something. So when Chazal see repetition that's not necessary, that's the place that they move in and do halachic derivation. The pasuk, you have this, please use whichever language you're comfortable in. Som tasim alecha melech asher Hashem elokecha asher yivchar bo Hashem elokecha mikerev achecha tasim alecha melech lo tuchal latet alecha ish nochri asher lo achicha hu. You shall place upon you a king whom Hashem your God has chosen from amongst your brethren. Shall you place upon you a king? You cannot place upon you a Gentile who is not your brother. There's a lot of repetition in this. If you divide the pasuk into three clauses, you'll see very easily the repetition between clause 2 and clause 3. What is it? And that's not what I'm interested in. I'm interested in the repetition between clause 1 and 2. But between clause 2 and 3, where do you see something repeated? He must be from amongst your brethren, and he cannot be a Gentile. So obviously Chazal are going to move in and discuss that, because you're saying the same thing twice in different words. But look at the first two clauses. Is there a way you could work those first two clauses into one clause? You shall place upon you a king whom Hashem, your God, has chosen. From amongst your brethren, you shall place upon you a king. Bracha?
So you just put from amongst your brethren, to the first part.
Good.
Of the sentence.
What have you eliminated by doing that? Do you hear what Bracha just did? Bracha started with Mikerev achecha tasim alecha melech asher yivchar bo Hashem elokecha. What have you just eliminated?
The need for a second clause. You Correct. The sentence more concise.
You've made the sentence more concise, and you have eliminated which words?
King.
Now, in Hebrew, everything is gender specific. A watermelon. Avatiach is masculine, whereas an agvania, tomato, is feminine. Every word is gender specific. If you look at Aseret HaDibrot, the Ten Commandments, they're written in the masculine. But Lo Tirtzach, you shall not murder, is a command to both women and men, not just to men, because there is no neuter gender in Hebrew. However, there is a way that you can indicate specifically the male gender. In other words, the male gender is commonly used to include both male and female. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, Hear, O Israel, is intended to include both men and women. Zachor et Yom HaShabbat LeKadsho, Sanctify Shabbat, or remember Shabbat, is in the male gender, but it includes men and women. How can you indicate specifically that this time you're using the male gender to refer only to the male gender? Ah, Mikerev Achecha, good. You're repeating from amongst your brethren two times, and therefore you're saying this is your brethren and not your sisters. That's one possibility. The alternative possibility...
I wasn't going to say alternative, so you could do
it. Okay. The alternative would be to do exactly as we did, to have Melech repeated twice when it is not necessary. And I think this is the reasoning that brings Chazal in source number 2, the Sifri, to say Melech v'lo Malka, a king and not a queen. Yes, we have 3 comments.
I was wondering if you could comment on the phrase, what's here in the English, whom the Almighty your God chooses, because this seems to very clearly be speaking about a king who God chooses, not a king who man chooses.
Yafet. And how you have a king whom God chooses during the First Temple period is relatively easy. You have a prophet who is the divine word, and therefore you can speak about God choosing. From the Second Temple period onwards, when prophecy ceases, how do you have God choosing? And the answer given by Chazal is that refers to choice by the Sanhedrin. And that's going to be relevant when in the 20th century, I think in the 50s, Chief Rabbi Uziel was asked about the election of a woman to a communal body. It could be the Knesset or some other communal body. And he's going to distinguish between appointment by the Sanhedrin as distinct from election, wherein the electorate voices its opinion. But give me a little while to get there. Yes.
So, 2 things. Number one, if God's choosing, presumably you can simply have the pasuk end with Asher Yivchar Hashem Elokecha, and that bow.
Yeah.
And that's it. You don't need anything else. He'll choose. And what do you need to tell him? Oh, and don't choose from, you know, choose Mikerev Achecha, you know, not the Nochri.
Well, if God's choice is coming via the Sanhedrin, the Sanhedrin does need instruction, because one might assume that whatever the Sanhedrin does has the divine imprimatur on it.
Right, assuming that the pasuk like pre-acknowledges or whatever the fact that there's going to be a Sanhedrin,
yeah,
and not a Navi. But fair enough. But the second point, not that it makes a difference, l'maaseh, but I mean, mikerev Achecha, or you know, Achecha, or Ahim, does that, you know, generally, if you looked at it in a concordance, would you find, you know, instances where that's used to refer to, you know, both brethren and sisters, you know, just to refer to both genders, both sexes?
Yeah. Shimon Chai Ami David HaMelech says, and he's referring to both. Lo Tisnai tachicha bilvavecha, ocher tochiach tamitecha. It refers to both. There are many instances. But I would like not to get hung up at this point because I want to give us enough time to get to the contemporary issues. I just wish there to be a good halachic understanding before we get to contemporary issues. Yes?
Sorry, I guess further hanging up about this point. It's just the context of the pasuk. On the repetition of Mikarev Rechecha, it seems to all be focused on the fact that you have to choose a Jewish king and not a non-Jewish king. That's, I'm just purely just looking at the context of the pasuk, that
you know,
that's what it all seems to be directed
to. I think
toward.
What I'm going to do is not address that.
Okay.
Because what I'd like to do is to get about it now. I'd like to leave the psukim in the Torah. I can answer that, but I'd like not to, because we'll stay in a place in this learning which is far from where we'd all like to get to. I'd like to move to contemporary situations rather than deal with how Chazal understood the Pasuk. The bottom line is, in source number 2, you have the Sifri. The Sifri is the Midrash Halacha and Dvarim, which comments Melech v'lo Malka, king and not a queen. And what I gave you is my understanding of how the Sifri got there. I have never seen that anywhere, so there may be other understandings of how Chazal derived a king and not a queen, but they get a king and not a queen. That is our given. Let's go on to Rambam. Rambam in 12th century, I guess, Egypt, wrote as follows. I said, I guess, Egypt, because Rambam's trajectory began in Spain, moved through Israel, and then Egypt. Rambam in Hilchot Melachim says as follows: Ein ma'amidin isha b'malchut she'nemar alecha melech v'lo malka. We do not appoint a woman to monarchy, as it says, upon you a king and not a queen. V'chein kol mesimot she'bisrael ein mamanim b'hem ela ish. And likewise, all appointments in Israel, we do not appoint other than a man. Now, no one for about 800 years could figure out where Rambam got his kol mesimot, all appointments. Rambam is a codifier of Jewish law. He cannot create Jewish law. What Rambam did in his brilliance was decide to set a code, an organized code, before Israel, as distinct from the need to study Talmud where you have the process of derivation, and sometimes the law is found in several different locations. Came Rambam, and with a commanding knowledge of Torah Sheba'al Peh, created a code of Jewish law. Rambam does not create. What he does do is choose between different positions, and he has a set guide for what makes him choose this position or that position when Chazal articulate more than one position. But nowhere within Chazal is there a source for kol mesimot. Nowhere within a source is there, within Chazal, is there a source for this restricting the appointment of women to any appointed position. What happened about 800 years after Rambam is that Rabbi Moshe Feinstein figured it out. And what he figured out was as follows. He says the Gemara in Yevamot looks at those last two clauses of the Pasuk that would seem to be repeating each other. From amongst your brethren shall you appoint a king, you cannot appoint a non-Jew. And he says, the Gemara in Yevamot reasons, the second clause deals with appointment of a king. The third clause, look at it, does it say anything about a king?
No.
What does it say? It says you cannot appoint a Gentile who is not your brother. So the Gemara in Yevamot says, clause number 2 deals with a king. Clause number 3 deals with all appointments. Rabbi Feinstein said, I imagine that what Rambam, or I understand that what Rambam was doing is looking at the pasuk as a gestalt and reasoning that if clause number one has to do with restriction of a woman, clause number two has to do with appointment of a king, clause number three has to do with general appointments, then a woman is also restricted from general appointments. That was Rabbi Feinstein's explanation of Rambam's opinion, which remained a dilemma for all of Rambam's Nosei Kelim, for all of the super commentaries on Rambam. Everyone says, where did Rambam get this from? But I wish to go on because I'm just laying the basis now for the contemporary discussion. If you look at source number four, Radbaz, Rabbi David Ben Zimra, was the preeminent rabbinic scholar or rabbinic leader in Egypt in the 16th century. And Rabbi the Radbaz says, well, I have a problem with Rambam because there seems to be a biblical precedent which he is contradicting. If he says you can't appoint a woman to an authority position, we all think of a woman who is in an authority position, and that is Dvorah. If we were talking about a wicked woman such as Isabel, we would say, well, she was contravening the law, but this is a prophetess of God. So Radbaz says, and he is going to follow, the format that he follows is going to be followed by all of the Rishonim. He says as follows, "V'im tomer haktivu dvara itcha nivia, he shoftai Yisrael beitahi." And if you say Dvorah was a prophetess, she judged Israel at this time, lo kashia, we now have two answers to this. Shaita melamedet lahem hamishpatim, inami al pi hadibur haya. How can Rambam say you can't appoint a woman to an appointed position if we have a biblical precedent of not just a righteous woman, but Dvorah, God's prophetess, who was, it says, she judged Israel. That is quite obviously a high position. So he gives two answers. Position number one is she wasn't a judge. She's Hayta melamedet lahem hamishpatim. She taught them the laws. What does that mean? She taught them the laws.
She was an educator.
An educator for whom? Any of you who know Sefer Shotim vayalu eilah habnei Israel lamishpat, Israel came up to her for judgment. In other words, she wasn't a fourth grade dinim teacher. She was a teacher for all Israel. Possibility number two. Exactly. That's what the Birkei Yosef, the 18th century great Yerushalmi Rabbi Vechida says, she Paskin Shiloh. She was the high rabbinic authority for Israel.
How does that get you out of the problem that seems exacerbated?
How does it get us out of the problem? It does not. It does not. Just give me one moment. Or else we say she was a judge, but it was by divine appointment. In other words, God is not restricted by the restriction against appointing a woman to a position. Now, position A, you have this. You have two positions, and I want to go through all the Rishonim within 5 minutes because we have to have time for the contemporary situation. Radbaz has two positions. How can Rambam say that a woman cannot be appointed to a misima, an appointed position, if we have Dvorah, who was a judge? Position A is what? She wasn't a judge, she was a
teacher.
A teacher of the law, in other words, a halachic authority. Why is that not a problem?
What other meaning would judge? Oh, I'm sorry.
Many other readings. The second position is she was a judge, but what? God appointed her, so it's not a problem. The first position, Radbaz is saying Rambam would not have any problem with her being a poseket halakha. Why? No, that's position number two. She was a judge.
She was not appointed.
A posek halakha, is a posek appointed? Who decides who will go to which posek and who will go to another posek? The individual. It is not an appointed position. So here, as I said, I want you to see the Rishonim because the parameters for our contemporary discussion are being laid down here. The issue here has to do not with serving in a particular capacity, but has to do with what? The process by which one gets to that position and appointment is being restricted. Now, leave behind you Melech v'lo Malka. There is a second issue, which is also going to be where also there is going to be a conflict with Zvora, and that is that a woman, by Jewish law, cannot give testimony. The Gemara in Nida tells us that anyone who can judge, kol ha-kasher ladun kasher la'id, anyone who can judge can give testimony. It's very logical. If I can judge, I can also be on the other side giving testimony that the judge is receiving. And Tosfot, Ramban, and Rashba are all going to say, how can you say a woman cannot judge if what? If Dvorah was a judge. In all cases, there are going to be two answers. One answer is going to be she was not a judge, she was something else, and it is called a judge, but it is not a judge, just as the Radbaz said. And position number two is going to be she was a judge, but there was some permissibility of her doing it. Now, look at, I'm giving you now two positions. One is Tosfot, number five. Tosfot say, I'm just going to summarize this so we can give time to the contemporary. From the middle of the second line, V'hadichtivi shoftat Yisrael, we have said a woman cannot judge because she cannot testify, but it says she judged Israel. Ikan lemeimai, one must say, and now we have our two answers. Shaita melamedet lahem hadinim. The same answer that is afterwards given by the Radbaz. She was teaching them the judgments. In other words, was she an active courtroom judge? Is there any judge sitting there? Okay. She was not an active courtroom judge, but what was she doing? She was teaching them the judgments. In other words, she was, as our friend here says, poseket halacha. Or, lefi shaitan viya hayu mekablim ota alehem. Because she was a prophetess, they accepted her. Now, what is referred to here, you may be familiar with the term Beit Din Zabla. Zabla is an abbreviation for what we would call in English arbitration or mediation. Ze borer lo echad veze borer lo echad vashnayim borerim lahem od echad. If two people who have a quarrel seek, instead of going to the court, to go before a court that they set up, that is okay. And each one will choose a judge. This one will choose this judge, this one will choose a judge, and the two judges will choose the third judge. That process is called accepting. They accepted her upon them, and that is permissible. In other words, you get again into the situation where Dvorah cannot be an appointed judge, but what can she do? She can judge if she is selected by the parties to judge. So because she was a prophetess, they accepted her. Now, Ramban gives an alternative, and I want to read Ramban, not in Ramban, I want to read it in Rashba, his student, because it's a little clearer in Rashba, but this is Ramban's position. And that is source number 7. Rashba says, "V'im tomar haktiv hi shoftat Yisrael, yesh lomar d'lo shofta mamash elam naheget." Rashba says, one should say, she wasn't an actual judge, but she was a political leader. Kashoftim sheshaftu et Yisrael. This is so fine. Just like the political leaders who led Israel at that time. The second book of the prophets, what's it called? Shoftim, judges. Is it referring to courtroom judges? Was Shimshon a courtroom judge? No, what was he? A leader. So Rashba says, following Ramban, that when we say Dvorah was a judge, there is no conflict here with the fact that a woman can't judge, because she wasn't a judge. She was just the prime minister. In other words, what are you getting about women's roles?
If the community accepts that it's fine.
And that there is that which is prohibited and there is that which is not prohibited. And if that which is not prohibited happens to be more powerful than that which is prohibited, that the issue is not limiting women, it's that there is a specific role which in a certain fashion is restricted. In another fashion it's not restricted. So then he goes on to say, V'afal gav damrinan b'sifri som tasim alecha melech, melech v'lo malka, hatem lo minu ota. El hayu nohagim b'akedin malka v'hayu nohagim al piha. Dvorah was a political leader and she was not a coronated king, limshoach in English? She was not an anointed king, but they acted with her as a king. In other words, they vested in her the authority, and that's what she did. Yes?
So, it seems like going through all the Rishonim, they are trying, times doesn't know slightly to make sure that she's not a judge. But where did they get this firm idea? How do they know that the woman can't be a judge? That's the piece of the jigsaw.
You're right. You're absolutely right. I accepted that as a given without explaining where it comes from. It comes, the prohibition against women to testify comes from Pasuk Va'amdu Shnei Ha'anashim, from which Chazal derive, maybe it could be written more compactly, Va'amdu Hashnaim, that only men and not women are permitted to testify. Then there is the halachic reasoning that if you are permitted to judge, all the more so you must, if you can receive testimony, you certainly can testify. That's the process through which this is derived. Now, the Ramban goes on to say, "V'inami shofetet v'dana," or perhaps she was a judge. Shehayu mekablim ota kederech shadam mekabel echad min hakrovim. People accepted her as they would accept a relative. What this means is, if I have a case with Moshe Rabbeinu's son, I and Gershom, the son of Moshe Rabbeinu, have a quarrel between us and we are going to the judge. And I say, I wish Moshe Rabbeinu to be the judge that I am choosing. Moshe says, I can't judge. That's my son. I say, I believe you are a man of integrity, you are impartial, I wish you to be my judge. That's fine. In other words, I have accepted him on me, even though by law he would be disqualified from judging, kiblu ha'alehem. Let me review everything that I've done now, because now I want to get into the contemporary questions. Okay, what have we said? We've said that there is a biblical precedent that would seem to be in conflict with the restriction upon a woman to serve in certain positions of authority. In the case of Rambam, we would have thought that the restriction was across the board, because the Rambam says, "Kol mesibot," a woman may not be appointed to any mesima. Comes the Radbaz and says, "I can show you in two different ways that there is no problem with Rambam's position, despite Dvorah." Why? Number one, we can say Dvorah was not a judge, an actual courtroom judge, but that she was a teacher of the law. And the point here is, being a teacher of the law, or as you said, what's your name, please?
Yehuda.
As Yehuda said, a poseket halacha, and the Birkei Yosef agrees with you, is not contravening in any way Rambam's stipulation against Masima. Or else she was a judge, but God appointed her. Then we went to Tosfot, and then to Ramban and Rashba. Tosfot says either she was not a judge or she was a judge. If she was not a judge, what was she doing? Same position as Rabbaz. She was teaching them. She was a poseket halacha. Or she was a judge, and there the different that because she was a prophetess, they accepted her, and Ramban and then Rashba refined this to make us understand that because she was a prophetess, perhaps might be the reason why they accepted her, but the mechanism through which they accepted her is open to any woman. Kiblua aleihim. The alternative position is that of Ramban and Rashba, that she was not a judge, she was a political leader. Now, those are the positions you have in the Rishonim, and through this discussion, you are dealing with an elephant as the side of a sukkah. In other words, it is absolutely theoretical, it's fascinating, but it is as theoretical as that elephant as the side of a sukkah, because we are not dealing with any woman that we are thinking of putting into an authority position until we get to the 20th century. Yes. No, not at all. What they are doing is saying, and I think in the case of the Ramban, it's absolutely logical. Ramban is saying, take a look at this period in Jewish history. Look at the Book of Judges. In the Book of Judges, were those judges courtroom judges? No. The name of the leader was judge. Why that's the case is probably because there was also some judicial authority vested in him. But when we talk about Shoftim, we're talking about the leaders of that time. So Ramban says there is no restriction on Dvorah being a political leader. I mean, what I would like us to get out of this discussion is that the Rishonim are conscious of the fact that there are certain restrictions on women's positions, but there are other places where there are no restrictions, and there is no reason to impose restriction when halacha does not restrict. That's very, very important for us to see, because I want us to move now into the contemporary situations. Yes?
How did Deborah get to be the leader of the people if she wasn't appointed by somebody? It's just organic? Like, you just become the leader? Or, like, if you're not appointed, what does that mean?
Well, is there an... you know what you're asking about? You're asking about political theory, which is, we know today how someone becomes a leader. In the United States, you go to the polls and you choose your leader. We also know that kings were not chosen at the polls, but there was a dynasty, and the position was inherited, and occasionally the king was assassinated, and another dynasty would move in, but it was imposed from above rather than chosen from below. The point that you're noting is going to be noted by Rabbi Uziel. So give me a minute to get to him. We have two comments here, but with your permission, I really want to get to contemporary situations, and I just wanted us to have the background. So I'm, with your permission, going to cut off anything that is not germane to what comes afterwards. Yes.
Okay. With that noted, just like assuming for a second that, you know, so we have this, you know, alternative source for why women cannot be dayanim, and I really don't see how that is problematic for
alternative source.
The Gemara, right, that says that a woman cannot be an aid, and therefore she can't be a dayan. Fine.
Yeah.
I don't really see a problem because dayan and shofet and din and mishpat are not the same things. But what I wanted to ask was, why did anyone, it just seems like with this one Rambam out of nowhere that people have to search for about a millennium to find a reasoning for, were there no Rishonim, no Achronim who simply said, I differ with this Rambam? And Melech and this whole pasuk in Dvarim.
The answer is yes, and give me a moment, and I'll point that out. Yes, again, via Rabbi Feinstein.
Okay, just building on the question that was just asked. So it's true that back then, yes, but in that time, in more ancient time period, you had kings and dynasties. But at this particular point in Jewish history, they didn't have a king. And in fact, kings were not looked well upon, as evidenced by further on when, okay, the people, by the way, as you know, the people...
May I apologize to you? We want to get to the contemporary questions.
So can I ask one more? Okay.
Yes.
Okay, ask a question. The next question is, Salome Alexandra, do the rabbis ever touch on her in the Gemara?
Of course.
Of course. And I grant her she was one of the Chashmonaim, and that the whole issue, they weren't supposed to be kings or queens in the first place, but do they, and
yes.
Did it ever factor in her story?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Okay, let's go to the 20th century. I'm sorry for being impolite, I apologize, but I needed to give you the background so that we could intelligently discuss what begins happening when the world begins changing and women begin acquiring secular educations and gradually moving into the professional world, and there develops a kind of dissonance between what has been within Jewish society and the way women are functioning in the larger world. In this began expressing itself in many, many, many questions, and they all start in the 1950s, post-World War II. So I'm going to summarize. I'm not going to read the positions within until we get to what I think you have precipitated. But I want to put this into a larger context. There was a question that arose that was asked to Rav Moshe Feinstein, and it was whether a woman, you have a piece of it here, it is translated into English, I very much suggest that everyone read it, but I'm now just going to summarize what Rabbi Feinstein said. This is number 8, Igrot Moshe. The question was asked to Rabbi Feinstein, can a woman succeed her husband as a mashgichat kashrut, as a kashrut supervisor? And it was asked because a man who had been serving as a mashgiach kashrut passed away, leaving a widow and young children. And the widow came to whoever it was and said, I know kashrut well, I can supervise, and without this, without the income that my husband had brought in, I have no way of supporting our family. So the question was brought to Rabbi Feinstein, and he said, well, first let us figure out whether being a mashgiach kashrut is an authority position. And he says that what makes something an authority position is not its prominence, but rather whether one has the right to act against the interests of one's employer. You may be employed as a mashgiach in a restaurant. As a mashgiach in a restaurant, you have the right to confiscate this shipment of meat. It is possible that the restaurant owner wants to use that shipment of meat, and you, the mashgiach, can confiscate it. Therefore, it is an authority position, and therefore, Rambam would say that you cannot appoint a woman to this position. However, it seems to me that the other Rishonim, says Rabbi Feinstein, and this answers the question that you were asking, it seems to me that the other Rishonim differ with Rambam. And therefore, for the sake of the sustenance of the widow and her children, I needn't follow the position of Rambam, and I may rely upon the other Rishonim who do not limit appointing a woman to an authority position. In other words, the other Rishonim limit appointing a woman to the position of king. But Kol Misimot is only found in the Rambam. Rabbi Feinstein, I add parenthetically, very frequently takes economic considerations into account. And Rabbi Feinstein says, in this case, for the sake of the widow and her children's support, I will rule not with Rambam, but with the other Rishonim, and say she can be, even though it is certainly an authority position, she can serve as Mashgichat Kashrut. And this is something which is extremely important, because Rabbi Feinstein was certainly aware that he was setting the precedent, and a rabbi in Brooklyn named Rabbi Amsel wrote to him right after he issued this ruling, saying, of course, you didn't mean to say what it sounds like you said. And Rabbi Feinstein wrote back saying to him, this is in Igra Moshe, you can read it. Rabbi Feinstein wrote back saying, I meant to say exactly what I said. Okay. So we now have issue number one, which became resolved in the 20th century. Yes?
I'm a little confused between position of authority and appointment. Appointment, I understood from the talk up until now, that appointment was the issue. It cannot appoint. But whether it's a position of authority or not, you know, I don't see where that came in. You know, so that if, let's say, if the, you know, in this situation, if the people, you know, who owned, you know, who whatever, you know, around said, oh, we want her, you know, rather than we're appointing her, wouldn't that get around the problem?
That will become discussed, not by Rabbi Feinstein, but Rabbi Uziel in Israel. But Rabbi Feinstein gave a suggestion saying, if you wish to be Yotzei the Rambam as well, if you wish to take the Rambam into consideration, let the woman work for the local rabbi. And then there can be no issue of Srara, because she is of authority, because it is not that she is an independent authority, she is employed by the rabbi.
So authority is the issue, it's not just appointment.
Rabbi Uziel is going to discuss appointment. For Rabbi Feinstein, because he is dealing with the Rambam, it has to do with authority. So he says, A, the other Rishonim don't agree with the Rambam. B, if I wish to be Yotzei the Rambam, what I will do is have her appoint. He suggested the community have the rabbi supervise her, have her work for the rabbi, and then there will be no issue.
Where is the Rambam's authority?
Mesima is Rabbi Feinstein's. If you read through his tshuva, you'll see that when he talks about misima, whether someone is an employee or in a misima, he talks about the ability to exercise authority independently. Now, the second area where women's appointment became discussed was in Europe, and afterwards in the United States and in Israel, where the question arose, can a woman be elected to the kihila? You know, the European communities, even to this day, for instance in Switzerland, have membership dues paid by a family, and the community is organized into a kihila, and the community provides basic services to the members. So the question arose, I think in the 50s, it was brought before the Sridei Eish, Rabbi, esteemed and great Rosh Yeshiva of Mantua, Switzerland, Rabbi Yechiel Yitzchak Weinberg, or Yitzchak Yechiel Weinberg, the Sridei Eish. And the question that was asked to him is, can a woman be elected or to the community governing board, Civic Kihila. Later on, that came to the United States as, can a woman be a president of a shul? And it came to Israel as, can a woman be a member of the religious council? It has not yet been discussed in Israel, can a woman be the head of a religious council? And I think that's going to be the next stage. But for right now, it's, can a woman be a member of the religious council? And 20 years ago, there was the famous case that was brought by Leah Shaktiel in Yerucham, if any of you are familiar with that. So the three-day Eish, Rabbi Yitzchak Yechiel Weinberg, answered as follows. He answered in two tshuvot. They are here, number 9 and number 10. In tshuva number 9, he says, we cannot prohibit women from being chosen, from being elected. However, it's against Jewish tradition. It is against the ethic of our mothers, where we all know Kol Kvuda Bat Melech Pnima, the glory of a woman is in the home. That's where the education of the children is, and it would be inappropriate, but it is not illegal. It is not illegal, but we all know that it's not the role that a woman should take. Several years later, the same question was asked to him. Oh, and in the first tshuva, he says, but don't make a fight out of it. In other words, halacha works that way. You're balancing different considerations against each other. And he says, do not make this into a quarrel within the community, because the value of peace within the community is extremely important. So that if there are those who are taking the position they wish to see a woman on the kehila, don't make this into a fight. But we all know that it's not proper. Several years later, the same question was asked to him, and he said, listen, in Israel, Rabbi Cook and others, and in Europe, Rabbi Chaim Moser Krasinski and others, have prohibited women from voting. Not just from not being elected, but from voting. On the other hand, Chief Rabbi Uziel in Israel permits women to be elected. He says in Tshuva number 10, really a remarkable, where is the Hebrew? Okay, he says in tshuva number 10, Lama li litkoit atzmi bimkom machloket shel oshim v'hamikirim, why should I place myself in the controversy between those who permit and those who prohibit? Naniach l'hadavar l'zman sheyachriya. Let us leave it to time to decide this. And I find that fascinating. Because what the Sri Deyesh is saying is, listen, I know that life is changing, the parameters are changing, and therefore they have ruled this way. A couple of years ago I said it's permissible, but it shouldn't be done. I'm not willing to say that any longer. It's really a wonderful example of a posek looking around and having the flexibility to say, I see that things are in flux, and this is an issue that I would rather not decide. Now, the third issue, and I'm going to go through this very quickly because I want time for the fourth issue, which is what I think you have had a role in bringing about. The third issue is that which I'm involved in, which has to do with women as a halachic authority. And what's fascinating about this is that there's no controversy about whether a woman can serve as a halachic authority, none whatsoever, until you reach the end of the 20th century, when women are becoming learned, and when the issue morphs from an elephant as the side of a sukkah to a possibility that we can see happening in our times. And I just wish to read together with you or refer to three sources, 12, 13, and 14. In source number 12, Sefer HaChinuch says, Shaloli Kanes Shatui Lamikdash. He's counting the mitzvot according to the order of the parshiot in the Torah, and he says one may not enter into the temple when one is drunk. V'chein shelo lehorot, and likewise when you may not issue a halachic ruling when one is drunk. And the way Sefer HaChinuch, who goes back to Spain in the 15th century, works is that he brings the mitzvah and then he says, to whom does this apply? So he says, to whom does this apply not to issue a halachic ruling when one is drunk? He says, this applies to men and it applies to wise women who are worthy of issuing a halachic ruling. Why does he separate men and women? Because the notion that you could have a woman who could issue a halachic ruling seems theoretical, and therefore he treats it that way. And the Minchat Chinuch, Rabbi Yosef Babad of Poland, 19th century, says, if im chachmei hador chalukim be'ezed din bisur v'heter, if we are dealing with ritual law, excluding those laws which need a beit din at the time of pronouncement, then it makes no difference who the person is. There is not a gender requirement. If we are dealing with a beit din, then we need a beit din kasher, then we need a qualified beit din. But if it is a matter of ritual, it is just a function of whether the person knows enough in order to rule. And the same thing is stated in number 14 by the Birkei Yosef, a little earlier. Birkei Yosef was the Chida Rabbi Chaim Yosef David Azulai, who said, even though a woman is disqualified from judging, a wise woman can pronounce a halachic ruling, and this is apparent from one of the options that are given to us by Tosfot. In other words, that Devorah was teaching the dinim means that she was issuing halachic rulings. I am very excited that you wish to have a Yoetzet Halacha in your community, and I look forward to your appointing a Yoetzet Halacha, and I know, of course, that Nechama Price and Bracha Ruttner have both been in contact with this community, and I'm very glad that that is the case. Now let's go on to another question, which I think would have arisen sooner or later, but you have made this question arise sooner, which is, can a woman immerse for Giyur before other women, or need a woman immerse for conversion before Beit Din of Men? Let me explain. Look with me at source number 15. Find it in whichever language you prefer. Amar Rabbi Chiya bar Abba, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Ger tzarich shlosha, Mishpat k'tiv bei. Rabbi Chiya bar Abba said, Rabbi Yochanan said, a convert requires three. It says judgment. The pasuk says, Ushfatetem tzedek, tanu rabbanan, ushfatem tzedek ben ishu ben achivu ben gero. Pasuk in Dvarim says, you shall judge righteously between a man and his brother and his convert. Mikan amar Rabbi Yehuda, ger shenitkayer b'veitin harei ze ger. From here, says Rabbi Yehuda, a convert who converts in a beit din is a convert. Beino levein atzmo eino ger. Between him and himself, he is not a ger. In other words, conversion is not a private matter, even though conversion involves acceptance of the yoke of heaven, and one might think that that is between man and God. Nevertheless, conversion also involves being welcomed into the community of Israel, and that demands a Beit Din. And then now the Gemara, there are ellipses because I've taken the Gemara in Yevamot over the course of two dapim for Amudim, and I've taken the germane parts. Ushnei Talmidei Chachamim Omdim Al Gavav. Now the immersion is as follows. The Gemara sorts the decision to convert or to convert someone into two stages. There is the stage that precedes the actual conversion, and then there is the actual conversion. Ushnei Talmidei Chachamim Omdim Al Gavav. And two scholars, this will be amended by Rabbi Yochanan into three, two scholars stand over him. In other words, when the person is immersing in the mikveh, there are two scholars, Rabbi Yochanan amends this to three, who stand over him. Umodin oto miktzat mitzvot kalot umiktzat mitzvot chamurot. And we inform him of a sampling of stringent mitzvot and simple mitzvot. We do both because the stringent mitzvot, a person needs to know what they're getting themselves into. The simple mitzvot, you might think to yourself, this is petty. Why does Judaism need to deal with this degree of detail? So the convert is in the mikveh, and at that time the Beit Din informs the convert at the last point. This is, you're about to cross the line, the point of no return. The Beit Din informs mitzvot, mitzvot kalot, miktzat mitzvot chamurot. Taval va'ala, he immerses himself and he arises. Harehu ki Yisrael chol dvarav. He is a Jew in all ways. Isha, a woman. Nashim moshivot otah b'mayim ad tzavara. Women place her in the water up to her neck. In other words, they accompany her in the in the tvila room. Ushnei talmidei chachamim omdim la mibachutz. And this will be amended by Rabbi Yochanan to be three. And the scholars stand outside. Umodi'in ota mitzvat miktzat mitzvot kalot umiktzat mitzvot chamurot. And they inform her of a sampling of the rigorous mitzvot, a sampling of the simple mitzvot. V'ha amar Rabbi Chiya, amar Rabbi Yochanan, ger tzarich shlosha. Rabbi Chiya says in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, a convert needs three. Ha amar Rabbi Yochanan latana tani shlosha. And the Gemara is amended to three. Now that is the process of conversion, wherein there is the pre-conversion and there is the conversion. The pre-conversion involves making certain that the convert really wishes, understands, and wishes to join the community of Israel. What about the conversion itself? So the conversion itself requires, at the time of conversion, that there be Kabbalat Ol Malchut Shamayim, that there be an acceptance of the yoke of heaven, and there also be an acceptance of mitzvot. How is this acceptance done? There are three positions. I'm going to go back to Rav Uziel. I brought you here a tshuva of his, but I would like to outline. There are three positions within the Rishonim. There is the position of the Nimukei Yosef. The Nimukei Yosef is Rabbi Yosef Chaviva, who lived in Spain in the 15th century. And his position is that if there is a conversion, not before Beit Din, if Beit Din is not present at the immersion, that is not a conversion. Second position comes from the Spaniards, Rambam and Ramban and others. And the second position is, it is a conversion if there is an immersion not before Beit Din, but that does not give one status to marry, until one again immerses properly before Beit Din. In other words, it's very interesting the way this halakha works. If one immerses without a Beit Din, that immersion is satisfactory. Let's just say I am converting, I immerse without a Beit Din, I get married, and I have a child. I cannot disqualify the Jewishness of that child, but let's just say I have a child out of wedlock, and now I wish to marry. That child that I had is Jewish. But if I myself wish to marry, I have to do another immersion before a Beit Din. That is the position of Rambam, of the Spaniards. The position of the Ashkenazim is, even without a Beit Din, as long as there are witnesses, that is a legitimate conversion. I'd like to show you this inside with two positions. I didn't bring you the Nimukei Yosef. Sources 16 and 17 are Rambam and Tosfot, as follows. Rambam says, V'tzarich lifbol bifnei shlosha, and one must immerse before three. Taval beinol veinatzmo, v'nitgayer beinol veinatzmo, v'afilu bifnei shnaim eino ger. If he immerses alone and converts alone, and even before two, he is not a convert. Giyoret sharainu hanoheget b'darkei Yisrael tamid. A woman convert, whom we observe following the ways of Israel always. For instance, I'm going to read this in English, she immerses fenida and separates challah from her dough and the like, and follows all the mitzvot. They are assumed to be righteous converts, even though there are not witnesses who testify for whom they converted. Nevertheless, if they come to marry into Israel, we do not marry them until they bring witnesses or until they immerse themselves before us, since they had been publicly recognized as Gentiles. In other words, Rambam says, before marriage, there must be a second immersion in the mikveh. Tosfot, on the other hand, says as follows, the Ashkenazim. Nireh davka b'kabalat mitzvot hu d'be'inan shlosha. We'll bring this over to women in a moment, but we always need the Rishonim. Tosfot says, it seems that specifically regarding the acceptance of mitzvot, the three are needed. But for immersion, one is enough if they have already accepted mitzvot. In other words, Tosfot says, listen, here's what you need. In the course of conversion, you have two things. You have Kabbalat Mitzvot, and you have Tevila. Kabbalat Mitzvot, acceptance of Mitzvot, must be done before Beit Din. Tevila does not require the presence of three. Immersion in the mikveh can have, you need to have some witness. It can even be one person. It doesn't need to be three. It's the acceptance of mitzvot that must be before Beit Din. Certainly to fulfill the mitzvah properly, three are needed, but that doesn't invalidate the conversion. Now let's go into the 20th century. Rabbi Ben Sion Meir Chai Uziel, whom I mentioned earlier, he was the first chief Sephardic chief rabbi in Israel. He had previously served served in Salonika as a rabbi. And when he was in Salonika, a very interesting question came before him. The question is as follows. I hope that's not mine. Okay. The question, the following question came in Salonika. The mikveh was located in the women's bathhouse. There was a public bathhouse for women, just as there was another public bathhouse for men. Today we take for granted that everyone has hot water in their homes, but that wasn't the case. And even when I moved to Israel, I was astounded. I've lived in Israel for 40-something years, and I became involved in the mikveh where we lived in the north of Israel in Beit She'an very quickly after we moved there. I was astounded to see whole families coming to the mikveh during the day to take a bath. Coming from the United States, I said, what's going on? This is the mikveh. And I was told, well, people come here to bathe. And I asked, where are they bathing? And the answer is, well, there are showers and there's hot water. And it's cold, and people want to take a hot shower, and therefore they're coming to the mikveh. So be aware that as recently as 40-something years ago in Israel, this was still the case that you had people in underprivileged areas who did not have hot water or did not have the means to heat up water in their homes. So the question was asked in Salonika. We have a woman who wants to convert. The mikveh is located in the women's bathhouse. Now, it's not appropriate for rabbis to go into the women's bathhouse, because even if the rabbi, the three rabbis, do not intend to look, there are women who are walking around, Gentile women, who are walking around in the bathhouse, not completely garbed, and therefore it is not tsanua, it's not modest. So, can a woman convert? How can, Rabbi Uziel was asked, how can a woman convert? The given is the rabbis cannot go there. And Rabbi Uziel stated as follows. I'll give you two different answers to that question, he said. And I think this is going to serve as a basis for a discussion that is going to now go on within contemporary life. Is there a way that you can have a conversion before women and not have the Beit Din there for that conversion? Rabbi Uziel sums up the three positions in the Rishonim that I gave you before. The Nimukei Yosef, the Rambam, Ramban, and on the other hand, the Ashkenazim, Tosfot, and the Mordechai. And I wish to read together with you his parts of his tshuva. Rabbi Uziel says, I'll tell you his bottom line, and then I'll tell you how he gets there. He says, one possibility is that we can say that the position of the Ashkenazim is credible, and that is that acceptance of the mitzvot must be before a Beit Din. He says the Beit Din are not coming into the mikveh in order to see that the woman is immersing. Why are the Beit Din needed in the mikveh? Because there's a conversation which needs to occur at the time the person, the man or the woman convert, are immersing. And that conversation is, do you truly accept the yoke of God? And do you accept the mitzvot? And he says, in his opinion, the reason Rambam rules that the Beit Din must be present at the time of immersion is so that there not be a time lapse between when one declares before the Beit Din, I accept the mitzvot, and when I immerse in the mikveh, lest one may say something happened between the declaration and between making the declaration legally final. And therefore you want the Beit Din to be there right before the immersion takes place. But says the Rambam, I'm sorry, says Rabbi Uziel, but it seems to me if that's not possible, then it's enough to follow the position of Tosfot and the Mordechai that the declaration must be before Beit Din, and then right afterwards the woman can go to the mikveh with other women. He has an alternative position. And I think it is this position that we are going to be hearing about in the coming months, and perhaps it will be the coming years, but I think this is going to be discussed. And as I said, it was I almost had goosebumps coming here, because I was saying to myself, I'm watching live halakha occur. You have introduced, you as a community have introduced something into the halachic discussion, and the halachic world is going to respond. Rabbi Uziel said the women can be appointed shlichot Beit Din. The same way that Rabbi Feinstein said that that woman can work for the rabbi, in which case you don't even have a problem with the position of Rambam of Svarah, Rabbi Uziel says those women, the three women, should come to Beit Din with the woman convert. And Beit Din should hear the woman convert make the declaration. And Beit Din should then appoint those three women to accompany immediately the convert to the mikveh, and Beit Din should instruct those women to be shlichot Beit Din, to be agents of the Beit Din, to hear the woman declare while she is in the water the declaration that she accepts the mitzvah. Says Rabbi Uziel, certainly in our situation where it is immodest for the rabbis to go into the mikveh, immodest and inappropriate, I believe that that would satisfy all requirements. So the issue of the modesty of rabbis coming into the mikveh has arisen. It arose in your community in a particular fashion, but it is a far greater issue than just the issue that is in this community, which is that you have a woman immersing. I don't know how many people in this room are converts. We were discussing this at my Shabbat table, and I've had the privilege of being involved in many, many conversions. The most recent one really put me to shame, and the reason is because one of my students was converting, a beloved student of mine, and I was accompanying her to the mikveh, and on my way, I grabbed a bottle of wine. I'm always in a hurry in the morning. I grabbed a bottle of wine and some little cups, and I went to my grocery, and I bought a cake, and I come into the mikveh, and as I said, I was put to shame by the Av Beit Din, by the head of the court, because as I'm starting to unpack, he takes out a homemade cake. And I say to myself, he has one up me in a very serious way. Such a beautiful, beautiful conversion. That notwithstanding, for any of you who have not either witnessed or been part of the procedure, when a woman immerses herself, she immerses herself before the rabbis come into the room, and then she dresses, she puts on a robe. The robe can be a raincoat. In Israel, American-style raincoats are not sold. You don't have those nice yellow raincoats. So you're wearing a robe. But the robe clings to one's body. It is not necessarily, it's not a simple situation. Over our Shabbat table, our guest this past Shabbat commented that she had braces on when she went to the mikveh. And while she was already in the mikveh, that was noted by the Beit Din. And there was a very difficult several minutes for her while the Beit Din were conferring about the halachic status of her braces. The bottom line is, whether it's braces, whether it's the fact that normally a particular woman may put on makeup all the time and that's the way she goes. This is not a judgment of whether makeup is good or makeup is bad. The point is that people have a way of in which they appear in public, and that it's disconcerting to appear before a rabbinic court when one is dressed less formally, even if one is covered, than one feels one should be dressed in the presence of august rabbis. So there is Rabbi Uziel's position, which I would like to read with you. I will read it with you in the English, with your permission, although I very much recommend that you go back to the Hebrew. Look at number 18. He says as follows, from what I stated above, we conclude that there are three views in this halacha. A, Nimukei Yosef holds that one who immerses not before Beit Din, it is as if he did not immerse, and he is a Gentile for all purposes. B, Rifan Rambam and Ramban hold that he is a convert in the sense that his offspring is considered part of Israel, but we don't marry them lechatchila, ab initio, until they immerse before a kosher Beit Din. See, Tosfot and Mordechai and Rosh and Tur and Shulchan Aruch hold that if acceptance of simple and difficult mitzvot took place before Beit Din, and he immersed before witnesses, he is a Jew in all ways, and they are permitted to marry into Israel. Since in the bathhouse where the mikveh is located, there are always women bathing. And the standing of a Beit Din beside the woman who is immersing is not permitted to any person, both by law. He means the local law in Salonika did not permit men to come into the women's bathhouse. And ethics, it's not a moral thing to do, and certainly not to rabbis to enter a woman's bathhouse. For even the convert, for even the convert herself is placed in water by women, according to halacha. And the judges are outside, and they inform her of simple mitzvot and difficult mitzvot while she is in the water. And afterwards she immerses before them, and they turn their backs so they will not see her when she comes out of the water. I just wish to say, parenthetically, that mikvaot in today's world are, the water is transparent. But that wasn't always the case. Behold... it is not permissible for the judges to look at her, neither before her immersion nor afterwards when she is not properly dressed. And when they go into the bathhouse where other women are bathing, it is not possible accidentally not to see. Therefore, it is not possible for the woman convert to immerse before a Beit Din. And when it is impossible, it is reasonable to say that... all will rule that according to all dayot, that her immersion, not before Beit Din, is sufficient for her to marry into Israel. And then he goes on to say, and to find a broader heter. In other words, I believe, says Rabbi Uziel, that everyone will agree with me that in a situation where it's impossible for Beit Din to go, so the woman can still convert, not before the Beit Din. And he argues the point that Rambam's position was predicated upon his concern for the gap in time between the declaration and the immersion. And he says, and to find a broader heter than simply my saying, I believe Rambam would agree with me. I say to establish that the woman convert should stand with three Jewish women before the Beit Din, and the Beit Din should inform her of simple and difficult mitzvot and their punishments according to the law, according to halacha. Then, after she accepts the yoke of mitzvot, they should instruct her to immediately proceed with the women who accompanied her in the Beit Din to immerse before them as agents, shlichot of the Beit Din, for accepting Judaism in all mitzvot, and so should the woman inform them during her immersion. In other words, when the woman immerses in the mikveh, what she should then do is declare her acceptance before these three women, and these three women now, as agents of the Beit Din, are not themselves a Beit Din. You're getting to the issue of can a woman be a judge? And this is not a case where two parties go to individuals for arbitration or mediation, arbitration. But here, these women are functioning as agents of the Beit Din for accepting Judaism and mitzvot, and so should the woman inform her during her immersion. And with this, it seems to me, her immersion is kosher, lechatchila, ab initio, to all opinions. So I think you, my friends, have introduced this discussion into the public domain, and it's there. Yes?
I have a question about agency. Was my understanding that a shomeret for a mikvah without conversion issues is an agent of the Rabbi.
No. A shomeret, or what's called a balanit, the Shulchan Aruch in Yoredeya says that a woman who is immersing requires to have beside her a woman who was age 12 or older in order to make certain that her hair is underwater. That is the function of a balanit, or what you call a shomeret. She is not an agent of anyone except the woman herself. The woman herself needs to immerse, and there are ways, if that is not possible, there are other ways of making certain that the hair is submerged. But the purpose is, in addition to many additional benefits, including safety, I think it is unsafe ever to use a mikveh if someone else is not in the building with you and should be in the room with you. That's just ABC of safety with water. But the purpose is to make certain that the hair is submerged, and the shomeret is the agent of the woman who is immersing. There is not required by Jewish law to be anyone to make sure that the mitzvah is being performed properly. The same way I don't need anyone to supervise whether I'm davening or whether I'm benching or whether I'm eating kosher or not. That's between me and God. Immersion, tefillah, is the same thing, except for the fact that when I'm immersing, I cannot see whether my hair is floating atop the water or submerged. And for that reason, and halacha says she needs to be 12 years or older. In other words, she doesn't need to be someone who is erudite. She needs to be someone who is able to see and to say your hair was underwater. Yes?
In conversion, I mean, is that also in conversion that she needs to make sure that her hair...
Yes,
you know?
Certainly.
Okay,
so certainly. Yes.
So why isn't this a more, like, widely accepted...
Well, that's why I'm so excited to be here. What I was trying to say to you at the beginning was, halakha has two channels. One channel is you have the codes of Jewish law. The other channel is you have issues which arise that generate what I would call case law. You have issues that arise which need to be addressed. In Salonika, the issue was that the women's mikveh was located within the general women's bathhouse, and therefore it was inappropriate for a rabbi to go in. But I think now what we're beginning to have in many, many issues is that suddenly we have women who are learned women. We didn't have this 30 years ago. My friends, this is something which has come into existence now. You have learned women. As a result of having learned women, you have the ability to examine practices in a somewhat different way from a women's vantage point and to say, I understand the halakha. It seems to me that practicing it in this fashion would be more pleasant for women. And that's what this is about. And I think now this will begin to be discussed. I cannot say whether there is going to be how long it will take. But my feeling is that this is something that is on its way, and that this community has had a role in introducing this into the public halachic discourse. It's phenomenal what you've done. Yes?
I think in just in terms of the conversion and the part of a woman's role, I feel like there's a lot of, liberties, but going to the mikvah, I would never expect someone to see me other than the shomeret the way that I am, without makeup or my hair uncovered or anything like that. This same holds true. I feel like we take that agency away from someone who wants to join our community. Does that make sense? With how you were saying, with the basin being in the mikvah and seeing the woman or the man in a way that they're not used to being seen.
There are various situations which are not entirely comfortable, where there's a kind of hierarchy, whenever one encounters hierarchy, it can be disquieting. When you know, for instance, in the case of conversion, that someone is going to rule upon your qualification to convert or not. For the Beit Din, there's a tremendous responsibility that's on their shoulder. For the convert, that moment is a disquieting moment. You don't know. You're being ruled upon, and you don't know whether they will judge you to be sincere or not sincere. And I have to say that I have sat through situations where people have made declarations and not held to the declarations. So everyone knows this. The mikveh situation is particularly acute because I mentioned the fact of makeup because it's not simply a question of being clothed. It's not that comfortable to have plastered down hair and when you're before another woman, so the woman understands, she's been there, she's done that, and I think it's much more comfortable, and I think Rabbi Uziel has given us two ways. He has said, number one, I believe Rambam is concerned about that time lapse, but I believe that we can rely upon and he gave us a long list, including the Shulchan Aruch, who say that the declaration needs to be made before Beit Din, but it is not necessary that the immersion be before Beit Din lechatchila. In other words, b'di'evid, it is kosher even if it is not, although it is desirable to do it before Beit Din. But then Rabbi Uziel has the suggestion of shlichut, which I think is wonderful. Let's see. Yes.
So, maybe taking this a step, I have a few questions, but I'll just ask one. The way this last question is being framed is, well, there's this unusual situation where, you know, the rabbis can't get into the mikveh, and therefore this workaround is found, and what you're proposing is that we take one of these workarounds, especially the second one, which is kind of more broadly applicable, and apply it to this situation today, you know, again, as kind of a workaround, and maybe, you know, and you're saying that this what's happened here is prompting this discussion. I mean, is there maybe a more, I'll say, machmir way to go about trying to effect this change and saying that basically that what's being done, what has been done up until this point, leaving aside the kind of strange situation in Salonika, doesn't conform with norms of tsniut the way that we would think of them today? In other words, that like outside of the context of a woman converting, presumably you would never have a situation where three males are seeing a woman in the state of undress that she is in the mikveh, even if she's wearing the robe, even if she's, like, you would never have that. So is there a way of saying, well, when we think about snoots and what it means for people today, that what's been done up until this point, even though it has been done and widely accepted, is significantly problematic enough that not only should we think about changing, but there's an imperative that it has to change.
I think you need to separate between two things. I think your question is great. I think you need to separate between what motivates us to do something and the fashion in which we're able to do something. What motivates us in this case is certainly the fact that the situation feels immodest. And I have spoken to many, many mitgayrot, and almost all have said the same thing, that it's an uncomfortable situation. Some have said it's uncomfortable, but it's also an exhilarating situation, very much depending upon the behavior of the dayanim. So that's what is prompting us to do it. But then the question is, well, how do we do it? How do you accomplish the mission halachically? And what Rabbi Uziel is doing is giving us the kelim, and I would like to say, I haven't read this firsthand. I was searching for this, but I haven't found it. Rav Waldenberg, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, also raised this, I think, in the 1950s in Israel as a possibility. Rav Waldenberg was a dayan. He came from Rav Eliezer Yehuda Waldenberg, from the high Haredi community. But it is not enough just to say it feels immodest, it feels inappropriate. You also have to know, well, how do we make a change within the machinery of halakha? And that's what Rabbi Uziel gives us in two separate ways. Yes?
To pick apart a little bit this Rabbi Uziel here, and he obviously uses shlichut instead of edut, the Torah shlichut instead of the Torah edut. So how does this differ than edut, so relying on these women to give their testimony? How is three women better than one woman? Also, he says that it's k'sher l'achila l'chol ha'deot, but obviously that's not true of the Nimukei Yosef, and the, you know, unless he's reinterpreting the Rambam in a way that I understood the Rambam to mean this, and everyone else.
That's what he's.
That's
what he is doing. If you're familiar with Rav Uziel, you know that he does that more than once and more than twice.
Okay. Well,
in other words, he is saying, "I don't understand Rambam's position." Unless what we are saying is that Rambam is requiring. He says, but I didn't translate it. But you have this in the Hebrew. He says it cannot be that Beit Din is required to come to see her immerse for the sake of witnessing that immersion. He says, why is Beit Din required to be there? Obviously because the immersion is the time of the acceptance of mitzvot. And for that reason, you require a Beit Din there. And for that reason, he says, I assume Rambam would agree with
me. So the like Nimukei Yosef and the others who read the Rambam, they didn't think of that before?
Nimukei Yosef
was
is...
Was he before the Rambam?
No, he is after the Rambam. Nimukei Yosef is the extreme position within the Rishonim that says even if a giyur of a man or a woman, if a giyur does not take place before Beit Din, it's not a giyur. That
right.
It needs...
Right.
It needs.
So Mechatilo L'Choladeo is not actually Mechatilo L'Choladeo.
No, it's correct, like, correct,
okay.
Correct.
But going back to that issue of Eidus, so Beit Din is basically saying to the women, you are my Edim, you are my Shlichim, you're my Edim.
No, no, not Edim. You are Shlichot in order to perform a function. In other words, you're not there in order to witness. He's very careful not to use the term witnessing.
Obviously.
What he is saying, and it's a witness in court that a woman cannot be. What he there are times that we accept a woman as a witness. There are cases of ne'emanut ha'isha when we accept the testimony of a woman. But what he is saying is you're being sent as agents, and your mission is to ask the woman and to report back to us on the woman's answer. In other words, the reporting back is needed for the Beit Din to accept that the woman has indeed accepted Malchut Shamayim.
So here's my question: if a Beit Din appointed a woman to be a dayan, and they said you judge this case, who is right and who is wrong, would that be okay? Because then she in fact is under the auspices of the Beit Din. The Beit Din says, "We'll take whatever you accept."
I'm trying to think, because Rabbi Uziel wrote about that issue as well. It is possible. I'm not going to say more than that. It is possible. It's a major discussion. Rabbi Uziel feels, in choice of a woman. When he's speaking about a woman in an elected position, he feels that when one participates in democratic elections, one accepts ipso facto the results of those elections, whether they're as I voted or not. If you're speaking about a judge, there is room in Rabbi Uziel's position, but I would prefer not to just summarize it off the cuff. I think we're in the process of finishing. Daniel,
I just
want to
ask a question about, because noted in a lot of these deos that if someone is in the process of converting and immerses in the mikvah, then to some extent that immersion is still valid. So we've had a situation that we've learned about relatively recently, many of us, that some people who were in the process of converting were going to the mikveh before they had gone to the beis din. Does that, would that in and of itself, you know, these sort of practice dunks as they're called, does that change, does the fact that they went to the mikveh bechlal while they're in the process of converting without having gone to the beis din, does that give them any kind of different status than if they had never gone to the mikveh at all?
I think the answer would be not, because they were not going with an intent to convert.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, first of all, just very quickly, also presumably they hadn't accepted the yoke of the mitzvot prior, right?
Before Beit Din. Before Beit Din.
Well, they have to do it before Beit Din, that's right.
Yeah.
So, okay.
But there's been a lot of discussion, you know, amongst people and on Facebook and everywhere about, you know, issues related to what we've been discussing. And what's come up repeatedly is, you know, people who say, well, where I lived, you know, the rabbis didn't go, they weren't there in the mikvah when the woman was immersing. I heard it over and over and over
again. For conversion.
Last night, our friends up to the north at Ohev Shalom Synagogue, Rabbi Krauss of the International Beit Din spoke about this very issue and said that when he did some conversions in St. Louis, the rabbis were not in the room for the conversions, for the immersion. And it just, what I don't understand is why this is so controversial. And it's not simply a matter of, well, some people do it this way, and some people do it that way, and we have opinions like this.
I would ask Rabbi Krauss where the rabbis were, because there are several different practices that I'm aware of. One of them is that everything has to do with the construction of the particular mikveh.
Right.
One possibility is that the rabbis are in the actual mikveh room.
Right.
Another possibility is that they're just behind the door. In other words, they're not in the mikveh room, but they are conversing with the woman.
Right.
There is a shomeret or balanit who's in the room with the woman. There may be some other women who are there. And the rabbis are behind a partition. My guess is that what Rabbi Krauss was talking about was that the rabbis were behind some kind of a partition. In some mikvaot, that is possible. In other mikvaot, it's not necessarily possible. Why is this controversial? Because the point is that the question, which is a new question, is can that declaration be made before women so that rabbis do not need to be anywhere near the building? Can this be done before
which
women?
Which specific declaration?
The declaration of accepting mitzvot.
Did we get an answer to that?
Rabbi Uziel's answer to it.
So is there a difference between one woman and three women, and that's the answer? They're like a quasi-Beit Din? Was that the answer?
I don't think Rabbi Uziel is looking for them to be a quasi-Beit Din. Why he said three people, three women, and not one woman, you can speculate, because it's not there in the tshuva.
I mean, what's so hard about simply them being right next to the mikveh? They have a conversation with her. She goes into the mikveh, takes care of it, with presumably a woman there to make sure that it's done right, leaves. All's well. Why is it so complicated?
Well, the preparation can be an hour long, and that represents a hiatus between the time of the declaration and the time of immersion. There are also, if you think of giyur, it's not always the giyur of one person. There can be 5 to 10 giyurim taking place the same day, and therefore the time lapse can be significant. Okay, I think we are going to end here, and I think we all have a sense that that we're living in a time where it is possible for a Jewish life to be responsive to women's needs, and I think ultimately that's just going to cause more use of mikvaot, more yirat shamayim, more ahavat Torah, and Baruch Hashem that we're all living in this time. Final.
Do you have any comment? I understand Rabbi Riskin is setting up, has set up a 7-year program for women to be. I don't know whether I don't know or it sounded terribly exciting to me.
I can comment about what's doing in my institution. Okay. I cannot comment about what's doing in other institutions. Okay, shalom. And I invite, as I do whenever I travel, I invite anyone who's here to come visit Nishmat, but not in the next month, though, because we're in construction. But after the next month, I invite all of the women who are here to come join us, to learn with us for any period of time. Shalom uleitov.
Thank you very much, Rabbanin, and we distributed the benches, so please don't forget to.
Rabbi Sain, Ibarek. Yishim Adonim Ibarach, Ve'etav Yadav Anbashus, Kavasim Bekhan Maranan, Rabbanan, Barasanech, Elohim Yishach Hamish, Allah. Rabbi Elohim Yishach Hamish, Allah, Ve'etav Yadav Anbashus, Kavasim Bekhan
Don't forget your recorder.